I next met with Dr. Amir Fathi from Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and to begin, he provided some perspective on where we are today in clinical research developments in the treatment of acute myeloid leukemia.
I think the timing of this interview actually in relation to AML is quite timely, mainly because for the last four decades, there has not been significant improvement in terms of our treatment of this disease, not much change. Since the mid-1970s, the approach to acute myeloid leukemia in the relatively robust patient has been intensive chemotherapy followed by consolidation, which could be either bone marrow transplant or additional chemotherapy. And in older patients, the treatment has been even more challenging. In the last decade and a half, hypomethylating agents in the form of azacitidine and decitabine have become available and are increasingly used. But the rate of remission that you achieve with those more gentle treatments are much more modest than you get with traditional chemotherapies. So there has been an intense need for improvements, and I think that in the last 5 years at least, there has been a marked increase in the development of targeted therapies in acute myeloid leukemia, at least their investigation. And very recently, midostaurin was approved for use in the upfront setting in patients who have FLT3 mutant acute myeloid leukemia. This is a subset of patients, younger patients with a FLT3 mutation. Midostaurin is combined with upfront traditional chemotherapy, as well as with subsequent consolidation chemotherapy in those folks that don't go on to transplant. And in the clinical trial that led to the approval, it provided a survival advantage, which is something that is rare, has been rare in our field. In addition to that, there are a series of targeted drugs and modalities of treatment that are under study that have the potential to be used in the future if they obviously provide what ultimately important and long-awaited outcomes that we are expecting them. Namely, these are IDH inhibitors. So in patients with acute myeloid leukemia that have either IDH1 mutations or IDH2 mutations, there are two drugs that are currently under clinical investigation. One's called enasidenib, the other one's called ivosidenib, IDH2 and IDH1 inhibitors respectively, that have shown significant promise in clinical trials, and we're awaiting additional results from ongoing studies to determine whether they have promise. In addition to that, we also have a BCL2 inhibitor, venetoclax, as well as the antibody drug conjugate, vadastuximab tallarine. Both are in combination with traditional gentle treatments, hypomethylating therapies, in patients who are not eligible for aggressive chemotherapies. Those two might ultimately prove increasingly promising and might be available for patients down the road.
So that's a great overview. Why don't we sort of go into a bunch of these things and also some of the work that you've done. I'm curious about your paper looking at cytogenetic evolution between diagnosis and relapse in AML. Can you comment on what you looked at there?
So this is a very interesting phenomenon, and not only for chromosomal changes, but also for mutational assessment as well. In the current era, when a patient is diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia, they have both cytogenetic testing, meaning karyotypic analysis of the leukemic or malignant cells in the marrow. In addition, they also have mutational profiling. Those testing parameters can be done at baseline, during the course of treatment, or at remission. And at least in academic centers, we don't necessarily recommend that these be done at every setting, but at academic centers, we can sort of see the evolution of the disease as changes occur. For example, certain karyotypic anomalies can go away. Some new ones can be detected at relapse or at time of remission. And additionally, mutational testing can signal the appearance or disappearance of various mutations during the course of the patient's disease diagnosis, treatment, and subsequent outcome, whether it's relapse or continued remission. So, and more recently, we can also kind of follow the variant allelic fraction, seeing whether the burden of mutation changes over time. This is not standard. This is something that we do academically at the current time. But over time, we might be able to kind of get a better idea of whether we can predict who will do well, who will relapse, and perhaps reserve the more aggressive approaches in those individuals who have remnant disease or new high-risk features once they achieve remission.
What about the issue of evolution as it relates to what you were talking about in terms of targeted therapy, specifically FLT3? How often do you see a patient who starts out to be FLT3 negative and becomes FLT3 positive and vice versa?
It's not too uncommon, to be honest, Neil. I mean, I think FLT3 mutations oftentimes portend a worse prognosis. About a third of patients in the upfront setting with acute myeloid leukemia have FLT3 mutations. There are two types. The more common variant is the internal tandem duplication variant, the ITD. The less common variant is the tyrosine kinase domain mutation, the TKD. Both oftentimes lead to a proliferative monocytic presentation of AML and a poor prognosis, not necessarily because these patients achieve remission at a lower rate, but they are much more likely to have relapses following that remission, whether it's after transplant or while in remission following chemotherapy. FLT3 mutations can go away following achievement of remission, and patients who are FLT3 wild type can have FLT3 ITD relapses because FLT3 mutations are considered later mutations in the evolution of AML as opposed to some of the earlier alterations that we see. We had a case recently of a patient at our hospital, which we've seen over the years here and there, who actually was diagnosed with a high-grade myelodysplasia, not AML, but high-grade myelodysplasia, with increased blasts, was FLT3 wild-type at diagnosis, underwent treatment with hypomethylating agents, achieved some degree of response, went to an allogeneic bone marrow transplant from a related donor, and approximately 9 to 12 months afterwards relapsed, but this time relapsed with fulminant FLT3 ITD aggressive AML. So in that setting, obviously the patient developed that FLT3 clone, probably persisted at a very low level, and then reemerged following the transplant.
From a practical point of view, what do you do if a patient starts out FLT3 negative and becomes FLT3 positive?
Well, I mean, you have to keep in mind the options, the management options that are available to you and which you can use. Obviously, there have not been FLT3 inhibiting agents that are approved for AML in the relapse refractory setting, but we have had available to us sorafenib, which is currently approved for use in solid tumor malignancies, as you know, renal cell and hepatocellular carcinoma. And it is also, being a fairly promiscuous and nonspecific tyrosine kinase inhibitor, a fairly potent inhibitor of the FLT3 ITD receptor tyrosine kinase. So having known that and being informed by important phase 1 and phase 2 clinical trials that sorafenib is a potent inhibitor of FLT3, we now fairly frequently use sorafenib in cases of relapsed and refractory acute myeloid leukemia. And oftentimes we get patients to enter at least a hematologic response. And there was actually a fairly recent publication that revealed that if you combine sorafenib with hypomethylating agents in the relapse setting, you actually get a good number of patients into remission. And that is important because you could potentially try then to prolong the remission, or if they have not been transplanted, to bridge them to transplant. We're hoping that in the forthcoming years, as additional FLT3 inhibitors are under clinical study and perhaps get approved, we will have additional FLT3 inhibitors that are more potent be available for our patients in the relapse refractory setting.
If you could access midostaurin in that relapse setting, would you utilize it?
Potentially, midostaurin, like some of the other FLT3 inhibitors and unlike sorafenib, inhibits both ITD and certain tyrosine kinase domain mutant AMLs. Sorafenib, as far as I know, is very potent against ITD, but not so potent against TKD mutations. Also, like the realm of TKIs available for CML, certain patients may tolerate one FLT3 inhibitor over another. So if we have a wealth of agents available to us, we may be able to make determinations as to which is best for which patient.
I want to explore a little bit more detail about the available FLT3 inhibitors and the data we have, but just before we leave hypomethylating agents, and particularly in older patients, any sort of, I'm not going to say mistakes, but things you see people doing with older patients or with hypomethylating agents that you think, you know, maybe could be improved upon?
So the hypomethylating agents have, in my view, both good and bad features. The good features is that they can be used in older patients or less clinically robust patients, mainly due to the improved tolerability of these drugs. Folks oftentimes do not have significant degrees of nausea or gastrointestinal toxicities. They don't lose their hair. I have given it to patients in their 90s. I've given it to patients over the age of 100. They're fairly well tolerated. tolerated. And I think part of this is related to the what we think is the underlying mechanism of action of hypomethylating agents. You know, they release methyl groups, allow for differentiation mainly through turning genes on that were inappropriately turned off. That process takes time. And genes turn on, cells again begin anew to differentiate and hopefully mature over time. And that process takes time, and it's more gentle and gradual, so that it is a well-tolerated drug that takes time to work in many patients. So, and that is why if you look at the majority of guidelines, they recommend treatment for up to 6 months. Now, I grant you, even I oftentimes cannot wait 6 months before I see a response in folks that are receiving azacitidine. In the case of azacitidine, I believe it's 6 months. In the case of decitabine, I believe it's less. But you have to give it time to work. Decitabine and azacitidine is not traditional intensive chemotherapy where you give the treatment, blood counts tank, meaning they go down quickly and then come up after a period of 2 to 3 weeks. With these drugs, there is a period of cytopenia. It's much more modest, but you would hope to have a response by 3 to 4 months following the start of treatment. There are patients who respond after one cycle, but the majority, it takes several cycles. So what I would advise community physicians is to give it some time, give it months. Unless the patient is rapidly proliferative, there is no way to get it under control, then obviously that is not a situation that's going to be amenable to treatment with hypomethylating agents. Although even in those scenarios, you could potentially control the blood counts with Hydrea concurrently with hypomethylating agents. So what I would say is it takes time. It doesn't work all the time. And when it works, the range of response is oftentimes going to be variable. Some patients have improvement in their blood count. Some patients have less transfusion dependence. And a minority of patients have complete remissions, but it takes time.
In the older patient, what's your usual therapy after hypomethylating agents?
Well, that's a good question. There isn't that much out there. And our recommendation is at least for patients to have opportunities to enroll on clinical trials if they're otherwise eligible. Even in the upfront setting, we recommend clinical trials in most settings. At academic centers such as where I work, we try and get majority of our patients if they're otherwise eligible on clinical trials. Once they go beyond hypomethylating agents, the options that are potentially available for them, depending on who they are and what they look like and their risk profile, are low-dose cytarabine, which is, I think, still being extensively used in Europe, but less so in the States, as well as lenalidomide, which, as you know, is a drug that's very effectively used in multiple myeloma and also lymphomas, but also has a range of efficacy in acute myeloid leukemia, with a minority of patients in the relapse refractory setting responding to lenalidomide.
So you said something that I don't recall anybody in any interview that I've ever done saying, and I've got to ask you about. Uh-oh. You referred to a patient that you treated over age 100.
Yes.
I've got to hear about that.
Well, this patient was very robust, very healthy, very talkative, very lovely lady. She was a swimmer, and I guess had been swimming up until a few years prior to me meeting her. But this is an important aspect. When you look at a patient, you have to take things into consideration. What did they look like prior to their diagnosis? Can you get them there and get them back there, you know, especially in older folks who may not fit a curative paradigm of treatment? And we thought that if we treated this patient and if she responded, she would have some quality of life. And she did. She had a certain degree of response. And she, I'm not sure if she went back to swimming, but she was able to achieve some of her life back. But there are certainly older patients. I've treated patients in their late 80s, 90s with hypomethylating agents. We even had patients in that range go on clinical trials. Although every time I do that, everybody gives me a look like, what are you doing? And I have to probably take extra acid-reducing medicines myself.
This lady was, how old was she?
100.
100 years. And was she swimming before she became ill?
Well, I think it was a few years prior, if I remember correctly.
Amazing. Yeah. Interesting. So let's talk a little bit more about FLT3 inhibitors. The two main ones, I guess, to talk about would be midostaurin, that, as you said, was recently approved, but also gilteritinib. I don't know if there are any other main ones we ought to talk about.
Well, there are a series of FLT3 inhibitors under study. So sorafenib has been studied, but it's now available because mainly it's been approved for other solid tumor malignancies. Quizartinib is another very potent selective FLT3 inhibitor. Gilteritinib is a very promising, very selective, meaning it doesn't hit many other tyrosine kinases, a FLT3 inhibitor, and it's shown a lot of promise as monotherapy in clinical trials, producing remissions by itself in relapse and refractory patients. Gilteritinib also hits TKD, so that makes it attractive in that sense. Crenolinib is also available, and crenolinib is also a very potent and selective FLT3 inhibitor. It also has the ability to hit various formations of the FLT3, including ITD and TKD. So there are a few out there, and there's even more that come along every day. I think the field is probably getting a little bit congested, but there might be room. One of the challenges with FLT3 mutant patients is that, let's say you have a person who's newly diagnosed with FLT3 ITD AML, which is the most common form of FLT3 mutation, and they've relapsed, and you treat them, let's say, with sorafenib or on a clinical trial with another FLT3 inhibitor. A common modality of subsequent resistance or subsequent relapse is development of secondary mutations. And so you have to start thinking about, can you then layer or sequence FLT3 inhibitors to try and prolong a patient's life and re-achieve a response.
So I'd like to go through a little bit some of the trials that have been done. But first, in terms of tolerability, toxicity, comparing these different agents, what are some of the issues?
Well, the more nonspecific a FLT3 inhibitor is, the more likely it is to have toxicity. So among the various less specific FLT3 inhibitors out there, such as sorafenib and midostaurin, and previous to that in clinical trials, lastortinib, you would see some degree of off-target effect. So gastrointestinal toxicity, liver enzyme elevations, those types of things were frequently and commonly seen, usually not particularly severe and manageable, but can be. With the more selective FLT3 inhibitors, the range of toxicity is less. I mean, the same types of toxicities can be seen, but they tend to be less common and less severe. So I think looking at, and that's what I mean, I think if you have more FLT3 inhibitors available to you, you could potentially make decisions regarding whether a patient should remain on one, should have dose reductions or adjustments, or go on to another FLT3 inhibitor that might be more tolerable for them.
So can you talk about the main trials, and particularly the big RATIFY-CLGB trial, but other major trials that have looked at midostaurin, how they use the midostaurin and how it now is currently approved, and what was seen there?
So the RATIFY trial, which is a very large phase 3 study, took a long time to get going, get crewed, and then ultimately get presented and led to this approval recently. The nature of the RATIFY trial was a randomized study of patients, younger patients with FLT3 mutations, either ITD or TKD. They received midostaurin at a dose of 50 milligrams twice a day with induction chemotherapy. And upon achieving remission, those patients who achieve remission then went on to receive cycles of cytarabine consolidation with midostaurin. And those who remained on study would receive midostaurin maintenance. Fortunately or unfortunately, a lot of these patients that were on this study also went on to transplant. If you went on to transplant, obviously, you did not receive continuing treatment. But regardless, whether you correct or censored for transplant or over the course of the entire study, there was a demonstration of improved survival. And that ultimately led to the approval of the combination of midostaurin in addition to 7+3 and consolidation chemotherapy for younger patients with FLT3 mutations. Midostaurin is also approved for use in systemic mastocytosis, a disease which I do not treat much, but it is at a slightly higher dose, I believe, in that for that indication. There are ongoing clinical trials that are looking now at the combination of chemotherapy plus other FLT3 inhibitors. They're very much still accruing and underway. There is also additional phase 3 studies that are looking at, or advanced phase studies that are looking at monotherapy. So FLT3 monotherapy versus standard of care conventional relapse refractory regimens to see if giving a patient FLT3 inhibitor monotherapy is better than what we have conventionally. So there are a lot of things that are ongoing, a lot of efforts to try and improve the armamentarium we have in treating our patients. So I look forward to it.
Can you talk about the magnitude of the impact in terms of efficacy outcomes that you get by adding in the midostaurin?
There is a substantial survival benefit. There's, I would say, a 33% improvement in survival. The rates of remission were not that different between patients who received placebo and those who received midostaurin. But ultimately, if you can demonstrate survival, which is very hard to do in AML or has been difficult to do, it's a big deal. And this was one of the few studies that did that. And that, I believe, led to its approval.
So So let's talk a little bit about the clinical research available on gilteritinib. You mentioned that it does have a different spectrum of activity. What's been seen in the clinical research?
Well, if you use gilteritinib by itself as monotherapy in relapse refractory patients and a subset of patients who are newly diagnosed and not eligible for conventional chemotherapy, you can basically get those folks into remission about 45% of the time, around that range. So, I mean, that is what we're looking at, even with conventional, more aggressive, more toxic treatment. So that is very promising. Why is that promising? Well, you can achieve remission. You can hopefully prolong their relapse-free and overall survival, but you can also bridge a substantial subset of these patients to a bone marrow transplant, a curative paradigm for some of these patients. So, and the same can be said about quizartinib as well, the other potent selective FLT3 inhibitor. Data has been presented that showed if you use quizartinib monotherapy, more than 40% of patients can achieve remissions, and some of them can go on to transplant. It is important to say, though, and I have brought this up before in various settings, that the remission that you achieve with targeted therapies, such as FLT3 inhibitors and IDH inhibitors, is different than the remission you get with intensive chemotherapy. Cytotoxic agents that you use as induction chemotherapy deplete the marrow. They cause basically emptying of the marrow, and you hope for a repopulation of normal healthy cells. That is, in my view, a kinetic remission. Basically, you hope that the good cells outpace the ugly cells that had taken over. With targeted treatments, especially in particular IDH inhibitors, but also FLT3 inhibitors, you see a lot of differentiation. You see a lot of cells learning, a lot of blasts learning to become mature and differentiate. And many of our patients, not many, but a subset of our patients actually have syndromes, meaning they have a rash, they have lung infiltrates, they have pleural effusions. So this is also an important aspect of treating patients with targeted therapies in the community, to be able to recognize a patient you have maybe on an IDH inhibitor or a FLT3 inhibitor who ultimately develops, if these drugs are ultimately approved, develops symptoms that are concerning for a differentiation syndrome and how to recognize it, when to make a decision about whether these folks need to be stabilized or hospitalized, and how to manage it.
How do you visualize the pathophysiology differentiation syndrome? And for example, how does it lead to pleural effusion?
That is something that I don't believe has been fully worked out, but it probably has something to do with a cytokine release mediated syndrome, where cells, as they mature and differentiate, infiltrate various tissues, including the lung, the pleura, sometimes the kidneys and skin, and lead to inflammatory manifestations. And the predominant approach to management of these situations is steroids, followed by a taper once patients stabilize. And this has been seen in a clearly differentiating therapy, such as what you use with acute promyelocytic leukemia. The predominant treatment there is all-trans-retinoic acid or arsenic. Those lead to very robust differentiation in the majority of patients, and a subset of them develop a differentiation syndrome that needs to be managed.
I'm curious if you have any thoughts about, there was an oral presentation at ASCO, deep molecular responses to gilteritinib to improve survival. Can you comment on that?
Well, the deeper your response, whether you assess that depth of remission by loss of FLT3 mutational detection or by flow cytometric analysis of minimal residual disease that's being done more and more, the more we have seen, at least in clinical trials, a lot of this needs to be further established by additional study, that oftentimes translates to longer remissions and perhaps even improved survival. A lot of this is clouded by what ultimately happens to these patients following achievement of remission. Some go to transplant, some achieve more chemotherapy. So it's hard to kind of know exactly what that translates to. But I personally, based on the data I've seen, believe that the deeper your remission is, the less likely you are ultimately to relapse, and probably you're going to have better outcomes.
So you mentioned IDH inhibitors, and you were part of a really great paper a few months ago in Leukemia reviewing this topic. Can you talk about the pathway involved here and the agents that are being looked at?
So the agents that are farthest ahead in clinical trials are enasidenib, which is currently under study in various settings as monotherapy, in combination with hypomethylating agents, in combination with chemotherapy, as a phase 3 study is looking at it compared to standard of care regimens. And acetinib is an IDH2 inhibitor. It's a potent inhibitor of IDH2. The way we think that IDH mutations promote leukemogenesis has to do with a suppression of differentiation, a suppression of maturation. And I've learned the Krebs cycle, I think, two or three times in my life and promptly forgot it about a year later. But one of the key enzymes in the Krebs cycle is isocitrate dehydrogenase, which converts isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate. The altered IDH protein, whether it's IDH2 or IDH1 that results from the mutation, actually causes another reaction to take place, which is the conversion. Instead of converting isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate, the altered enzyme converts alpha-ketoglutarate to 2-hydroxyglutarate, or 2-HG. 2-HG is a metabolite that you and I have at very low levels, at least I hope we have it at very low levels. And when it increases in its concentration in the body, whether it's in the serum, in the marrow, and by the way, it can be measured. We've shown that it can be measured and potentially may have promise as a biomarker. 2-HG can suppress the function of TET enzymes, which are essential for methylation profiles and differentiation of myeloid precursors. And in fact, if you have an IDH mutation, you're not likely to have a TET mutation. And if you have a TET mutation, you're unlikely to have an IDH mutation. And therefore, IDH mutations, through their release and increase of 2-HG, suppress maturation of myeloid precursors and promote leukemia. What IDH inhibitors do is they suppress that enzyme, suppress the production of 2-HG, 2-HG drops, and then cells begin anew to mature. And as a result, we've seen that that translates in clinical trials to a remission rate of around 20-something percent and a response rate of around 40-something percent. And many patients have stable disease, and that stable disease leads to folks having less periods of transfusion dependence, improved blood counts. So overall, many patients end up have remained, at least in my experience, on study for long periods of time doing well.
So you mentioned enasidenib, which I guess is IDH2.
That's right.
And then there's the other one is ivosidenib, which is
IDH1.
IDH1. So what's that mean?
It's actually the response, the proportion of response and the types of response are fairly similar between the two drugs. The only major difference between these cases is IDH1 is much less common than IDH2 in patients who have myeloid malignancies. So approximately 5 to 10% of patients have IDH1 mutations and approximately 15 to 20% of patients have IDH2 mutations. There are two forms of IDH2 mutations, and R140 and R172, as opposed to the IDH1 mutation, which is predominantly just one form that is seen in the majority of patients, R132. So it is less common IDH1 mutations, but in the majority of patients that we've studied, the range of toxicity, the tolerability has been very similar, and the range of response has also been quite overlapping.
But do you assay? Do you only use it in that type of mutation?
That's right. We don't have any reason to believe that patients who do not have IDH mutations are likely to respond to this form of treatment. The mechanism of action seems to be fairly well delineated. Suppression of 2-HG leads to maturation and differentiation in these patients. About 10 to 15% of them have differentiation syndromes, which can be very severe. So we do not have any reason to believe that they would be effective in wild-type patients.
And are there any tolerability issues with these agents?
There are some signals. They can cause a change in the level of bilirubins, but predominantly in folks that have perhaps a predisposition, such as those who have a Gilbert's type syndrome. And elevated bilirubin does not seem to have additional sequela, at least in the initial studies that has looked at it. For the most part, they're well tolerated. There isn't a substantial emptying of the marrow, a decrease in blood counts. The one challenge that I always like to highlight when we talk about IDH1 and IDH2 inhibitors is the potential for differentiation and differentiation syndrome, which, because of its pulmonary manifestations in particular, can have life-threatening implications.
What about efficacy? What's seen with these two agents?
Well, the rate of remission is around 20-something percent. The rate of overall response, which includes partial remissions and morphologic leukemia-free state, in addition to complete remissions, is around 40-something percent, and many patients have stable disease. So a sizable proportion of patients that are treated have some degree of response to treatment.
Are these agents you would like to have in practice now?
Well, I could only speak for myself. I've been part of a group of folks that have been investigators on these trials, and I think they have significant promise. And I do believe that personally, I would like to have IDH inhibitors available to us for their use, yeah.
I have heard cases of people, you know, cases described to me of people who receive these agents who seem to have very useful responses. Has that been your experience?
Yeah. We have seen patients who have responded and have responded for months, have gone back to their lives, have had normal counts, have not had needs to come to the clinic recurrently for transfusions. There's dramatic and important responses. The other thing about IDH inhibitors that we should think about is that the responses take time. Again, I mean, it could be a matter of weeks to months before you actually see some activity.
This comes up in oncology so often with new agents. You know, have some where you add it to something else, chemotherapy. Sometimes it's hard to figure out. But, you know, when you see a relatively non-toxic oral agent that you can see is causing useful responses, when clinicians hear about that, they want to use it.
Yeah.
I guess there are other regulatory issues, though, huh?
What you're saying is very much happening as we speak. I mean, pretty much everything is being combined with hypomethylating agents. I'm obviously exaggerating a bit, but you have antibody drug conjugates, you have venetoclax, you have IDH inhibitors, you have a whole host of different targeted therapies being combined with hypomethylating agents for use in older patients or those folks who do not tolerate intensive upfront strategies. So I agree. I mean, I think hypomethylating agents are generally well tolerated, so in that way, they're probably optimized for combination therapy.
So I'm curious about your thoughts about CPX-351, liposomal cytarabine, daunorubicin.
Well, that's another potential compound that might be available to us over the course of the next few years, maybe sooner, I don't know. It has shown improved survival in patients with high-risk AML in a clinical trial. The rates of remission on these trials were really low. I was surprised by that. But these are also high-risk patients that they studied. But they did show that those individuals who received this particular liposomal compound did better than traditional conventional chemotherapy. We'll have to see if ultimately it does get approved and is available and whether we would use it. As an institution, we have not used that combination on clinical trials, but I have heard that it is fairly well tolerated and the data may very well speak for itself.
What's the potential theoretical explanation for why you might see improved efficacy?
Well, it's hard to know. I think sometimes it's related to drug delivery to the tumor, but also among older patients or those who are more likely to have high-risk AML, tolerability is an important aspect of it. So if your drug is more tolerable, and some suggest that perhaps this formulation is, you're less likely to have challenges or complications and even morbidity and mortality related to treatment.
So it's interesting reflecting back on what you were saying about how there wasn't much going on. I mean, we're still talking about AML, and I'm not down my list yet because the next one I want to ask you about, you mentioned before, which is venetoclax. What do we know about venetoclax? Obviously, it's being used now in CLL. It's being looked at with other diseases, mantle cell, myeloma. What about AML?
I think it has a lot of promise. It's interesting. Venetoclax by itself has some activity, but it's modest. When you combine it with HMA, all of a sudden you have this fairly impressive, at least in these initial trials, fairly impressive rates of remission. And that's very promising, and I think it requires additional study in larger trials to see that if this truly pans out, because patients can potentially benefit from combination therapy. You know, the challenge with hypomethylating agents among older patients or less fit patients is that although well tolerated, the rates of remission were pretty low, around, you know, 15% to 25% compared to a standard chemotherapy, which is in most situations north of 50-60%. So if you can improve the response rate, the rate of remission, and maintain tolerability, well, that's a great thing. That's ultimately what we always going to be aiming for these patients.
What about tumor lysis syndrome? Obviously, that's a big concern in CLL. I've heard maybe not so much a concern in myeloma and mantle cell. What about AML?
There is that concern. I mean, AML, like CLL, has a propensity to lyse easily. Patients can come and get sick. The majority of trials that have looked at venetoclax have tried to dose escalate gently to ameliorate the potential effects of tumor lysis and the clinical syndrome that arises from it. So I think it's an important consideration. But nevertheless, venetoclax plus HMA seems to produce a very impressive and robust rate of remission, similar to other HMA combinations, such as that with an antibody drug conjugate against CD33.
So I didn't know if we were ever going to hear about hedgehog inhibitors again, because, you know, we were talking about that a few years ago and still in basal cell of the skin. But now I see hedgehog inhibitors coming to AML, maybe glasdegib.
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, I'll have to see more data with this particular agent. I think there is a lot to say about the hedgehog inhibitors and the pathways that are potentially mediating leukemic stem cell persistence. There is trials that are looking at it and demonstrating some promise, as you just mentioned, whether it will potentially pan out and be available for us and whether it will compete well with the other strategies that we've talked about today, we'll have to see.
Any experience with this agent?
I personally have not. So we have not, as an institution, been on clinical trials. I have not had patients on it. I've presented and published literature, and I've spoken to other investigators who've treated patients on it.
Do you know Keith Flaherty?
I do.
I think I remember talking to him about it, not about this one, but about vismodegib. And you know, the weird thing about that, and I was curious whether they see it with this agent, was this really weird dysgeusia, really profound lack of taste. Do you know if you see that with this one?
I've heard of it, and I've actually spoken to Keith about this, so he's brought this up to me as well. It's a kind of an interesting phenomenon, which seems to impact, the sort of direct impact on what you're sort of inhibiting there with that particular agent and the effect on your taste buds.
Yeah, I think he said they let patients stop the drug for Thanksgiving, you know, so they can eat.
Yeah, seriously.
Okay, well, let's go on. I want to ask you about gemtuzumab, old story. What's up with that?
Well, gemtuzumab, as far as I know, is still not available, but there is a lot of interest, I think, in potentially having antibody-drug conjugates available in AML. One of the challenges with gemtuzumab, as you know, historically, has been the potential liver toxicity, particularly veno-occlusive disease. And that has been difficult because, especially in AML, a lot of your patients you're going to have who are relapse refractory following transplant, who already potentially are at risk, have already received myeloablative regimens, such as with busulfan, and might be at risk for this particular entity. So that has been a consideration and a concern in the past. But since the drug was withdrawn, there have been a series of additional trials that have basically been presented that have suggested that maybe adding gemtuzumab to traditional treatments improves outcomes in various patient populations. So there has been some interest in potentially, again, looking at this and seeing if it again becomes available in the States.
Alisertib's not worth talking about, or is it? I know you've studied it.
I personally think that it's worth maybe mentioning. Alisertib is an Aurora A kinase inhibitor. It's been studied in various settings, including lymphoid malignancies. In AML, we did a phase 1 study. We showed that it was tolerable in combination with induction chemotherapy. And we had a remission rate north of 80%. And among patients who were evaluable, all but one achieved remission, which in a phase 1 study, you can take it for what it's worth. But nevertheless, that number was impressive. We decided to do a subsequent phase 2 study in high-risk patients, meaning patients who had developed MDS AML, therapy-related AML, patients who had high-risk cytogenetics or mutational profiles. In that type of setting, we're currently doing a phase 2 study to see if combining or adding alisertib to chemotherapy perhaps improves the traditional low rates of remission in this high-risk patient population.
Any comments on immunotherapy, checkpoint inhibitors, CAR T therapy in AML?
I think very much in its infancy. Checkpoint inhibitors, which are, as you probably know and talk to various investigators across the country, is probably the most exciting thing that is currently under study in oncology. It is less exciting, it seems, in myeloid tumors. There is ongoing study, specifically in MDS and maybe some cases of low blast burden AML, but still very much in its infancy in terms of whether it will hold any water. As far as CAR T technologies, I think the majority of what we see with CAR Ts in terms of their promise is in ALL or CD19 expressing malignancies. There are efforts to look at CAR T technologies in AML, namely looking at CD33 or CD123 on the surface of myeloid blasts. But that is, from my understanding, much more complicated, much more challenging, and therefore it requires more study. Maybe something very promising in the future.
I was working with your colleague Nupur Rajay at ASCO, and sounds like it might be pretty hot in myeloma.
Yeah. No, there is a series of targets in myeloma that are currently being looked at. So CAR Ts are exciting in lymphomas and CLL and myeloma. We're always trying to catch up a little bit in myeloid malignancies, but maybe.
Well, at least you got something going here. Targeted therapy, you know, it's good. So before we move off of AML, maybe you can just briefly touch on the two cases you brought in here today. First, your 50-year-old man.
So this is the case that I alluded to earlier of an MDS patient who was FLT3 wild type but then relapsed with FLT3 ITD disease and whom we, in addition to hypomethylating therapy, we used sorafenib to try and get him into a remission. And he actually looks like he's responded nicely and is going to get, he's post-transplant, so he's going to get a donor lymphocyte infusion to help prolong his remission and is doing quite well right now. So it was an example of a patient who, I just wanted to provide you with an example of a patient who was had an evolution of his mutational profile from FLT3 wild type to FLT3 ITD, and as a result of that was eligible to receive a targeted form of treatment that seems to be at least currently successful.
I recall another case like that, and I remember thinking to myself, I'm curious what you think based on cases like this. I mean, do you recommend for a general medical oncologist, community-based practice who's managing an AML patient to do repeat mutational testing, looking, for example, for the evolution of FLT3?
You know, that's a tricky one, Neil. I personally think and do perform these tests because I feel that it helps me make decisions for my patients. But whether payers will pay for repeated testing for FLT3 mutational status, I don't know. So it's hard for me to make recommendations because it may complicate ultimately what is covered and what is not covered. I can tell you in this particular patient, it was very useful. And there are scenarios where I can see it being potentially useful, but it becomes much more complicated when you make more broad recommendations.
Maybe you can also comment on your 56-year-old man. I think this is really interesting in terms of what you were talking about before in terms of differentiation syndrome.
So, yeah, this is actually an interesting case that we presented and published not too long ago, where an individual received initial treatment with chemotherapy, subsequently relapsed and received a range of treatments which were not successful, and then from us received sorafenib, as I mentioned, a potent FLT3 inhibitor, and a few weeks later began to develop a syndrome, pulmonary nodules, and then a diffuse nodular eruption on his skin. We diagnosed him with a sweet syndrome, a neutrophilic dermatosis, and because it was suspicious that he had developed this on FLT3 inhibition, we actually looked at the cells, the neutrophils in his skin, and found them to be FLT3 mutant. And we also found them to have the cytogenetic anomalies that were present in his leukemic blasts, suggesting that those cells had differentiated and led to the manifestations of the syndrome.
That's really amazing. What exactly did they look like?
Hard nodules, some tender, but they can have pleomorphic manifestations. So it's not something that looks the same all the time.
So let's move on now, talk a little bit about ALL. First, maybe you can provide a little bit of a broad perspective on what you see as some of the more important developments of the disease. And I'm particularly interested in the issue of older patients. I see you were part of a paper talking about that.
So the way you phrased that question, I think, just introduces the main challenge of ALL, because ALL is a disease of predominantly children, pediatric population. And in that patient population, it carries currently a very good prognosis. The large majority of children who are diagnosed with B-cell ALL do well and survive. And many of them do not need bone marrow transplant. Things change as you get older and diagnosed with B-cell ALL. And thankfully, it's not as common in adults for that reason. Folks who are older with ALL tend to have a higher likelihood of having high-risk molecular and chromosomal features, such as a Philadelphia chromosome, such as an MLL rearrangement. Obviously, they're less likely because of comorbidities or other types of functional limitations to tolerate chemotherapy. Older folks, especially in their teens and 20s and maybe 30s, tend to be less compliant on average. Of course, there are exceptions to treatment. There is this idea and theory that children are oftentimes brought to the office to get their treatment by their parents, whereas adults are left to their own devices to misbehave, especially when they're in remission and feel better. So all these things, I think, are contributory to the overall picture which we see, which is a much lower rate of remission and a much lower survival, south of 50% in older ALL patients, and that is something that has become an increasing challenge. As far as treatment of ALL, the general approach traditionally or historically has been multi-agent chemotherapy, and there's various formulations out there. You can use HyperCVAD, you can use a CLGB regimen. In recent years, especially in folks who are younger, we call them adolescent and young adult patients, you can use a pediatric-inspired or a pediatric-derived multi-agent chemotherapy regimen, and those folks do significantly better than traditional adult regimens, suggesting that the intensive inclusive nature of pediatric regimens perhaps then translates into improved outcomes. And what are these intensive regimens? Where they're much more likely to include high doses of steroids for longer periods of time and increased and more liberal use of asparaginase. Nevertheless, these things cause toxicity in many patients. You know, you're much less likely to tolerate asparaginase when you're older. You're much less likely to tolerate steroids when you're older. But intensifying treatment for ALL has translated into better outcomes. And that applies across the board in ALL, and specifically in patients who have Philadelphia chromosome positive disease. We have seen in recent years that the addition of tyrosine kinase inhibitors such as imatinib and dasatinib and now ponatinib seem to have a very important role in the treatment. And when you combine these drugs with intensive chemotherapy, it seems that you make a real difference. And especially in patients who are older or older adults, you can simply combine the dasatinib or other tyrosine kinase inhibitors with steroids or steroids and vincristine and get many of these people, a large majority of them, into remission. And they tend to stay in remission for a long period of time. So I think the advent of tyrosine kinase inhibitors for Philadelphia chromosome positive patients, the intensification of upfront approaches that are inspired by pediatric approaches have likely led to improvements in ALL.
So maybe we can get into a couple of your cases to kind of draw out how that's playing out, beginning with your 55-year-old lady.
So this particular case, I think, highlights what we do in the relapse refractory setting. But she was an older female who received Hypercivat, which is a traditional multi-agent chemotherapy. And she actually achieved remission. Majority of patients with B-cell ALL achieve remission. The trouble is not the rate of remission. It's what happens afterwards oftentimes. And she went on to transplant. I believe she had minimal residual disease following remission, although she was in a morphologic remission. You could still detect some aberrant cells by flow cytometry, and because of that, we recommended allogeneic stem cell transplantation. She relapsed, unfortunately, as many of these patients do, not too long thereafter, was initially treated with gentle form of treatment called POMP, which is steroids and oral 6-MP and methotrexate, in addition to vincristine, and did not seem to have much disease control with that approach. And this was around the time where we had the approval of blinatumomab, which is the antibody that targets CD3 and CD19, and she ended up being one of our first series of patients at our hospital that received this following approval, and she had some of the classic toxicities that you can see with this drug. She had some fevers and generalized symptoms that seemed to have some consistency with cytokine release syndrome, and about a week into treatment had some mental status changes and confusion and neurotoxicity sort of presenting in various ways. You know, patients can have various different manifestations of neurotoxicity. She actually had some word-finding difficulties, some confusion that arose about a week or so into her treatment. That led to a pause in treatment, initiation of steroids, and resumption of the treatment at a lower dose, I believe. And she tolerated the rest of that cycle well. She ended up receiving another cycle and achieved a remission. Unfortunately, we found out fairly recently that she had relapsed in the CNS.
What's your plan for her at this point?
Well, she is currently with her family, not local, but from what I understand, the plan is to transition her to comfort measures.
So maybe you can talk a little bit about your experience with blinatumomab, how you currently utilize it, and particularly what you've observed and your experiences with toxicity.
I think it's a very effective and useful addition to what we currently have available for our patients. It is approved for use in Philadelphia negative relapsed B-cell ALL. It is somewhat cumbersome. There is a continuous infusion need for changing of cartridges, but patients, once they have it going, can continue on it and can be discharged from the hospital. The toxicities that oftentimes emerge during the first cycle of treatment are cytokine release syndrome, somewhat akin to what you see with CAR T cells, as well as neurotoxicity, which is a little bit scarier, but often transient. And once you can get patients through it, oftentimes with dosing adjustments or interruption and steroid use, patients, many of them, can achieve a nice response, obviously remissions in a sizable proportion of patients in the relapse refractory setting, which is very desirable. Many patients who have minimal residual disease or relapse disease can be bridged to a transplant, which is obviously a curative paradigm in this patient. That too is something that is very important. So blinatumomab currently has an important role to play in Philly negative disease.
Can you talk a little bit more about what's been seen in terms of toxicity, particularly neurotoxicity?
It can come in various shapes and sizes. There are folks that can have confusion, episodes of pre-epileptic or epileptic activity have been seen, focal neurologic deficits, and general non-specific neurologic decline has also been seen. Most of it transient, most of it manageable.
What is thought to be the mechanism of how this neurotoxicity occurs?
I don't think anybody clearly knows. I think there are many people that are looking at this, whether it's related to potential cytokine-mediated effects that are causing challenges for other tissues in the body, also having effect on the central nervous system, or whether it has something to do with the target, which is CD19 in this case. I don't know. I don't think many people know definitively, but it's a focus of fairly rigorous study.
Can you talk about your vision and maybe how you explain to your fellows or even your patients of how the drug works? I think it's really fascinating.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is kind of state of the art, like modern technology, right? I mean, it brings into close proximity T cells, which express CD3, and the aberrant leukemic B cell, which expresses CD19. And in that fashion, leads to cell killing through a T cell mediated process. So it is an engineered antibody that manages to do that, and it's very much targeted.
You mentioned before the issue of asparaginase. Can you talk about some of the clinical issues that come up and how you select the agent?
So right now we have E. coli asparaginase, the pegylated form, and we also have Erwinia. We try and use the pegylated asparaginase in our setting, but when it's not available or when there is issues with it, we also use Erwinia. The challenge with asparaginase in general in older patients is something we deal with frequently and something that causes a lot of challenge in a subset of patients is the toxicity. So you are more likely to have an allergic response, a reaction during infusion of asparaginase. If you are older, you're more likely to have tissue injury, pancreatitis, hepatitis, rash, and those can be very challenging and sometimes lethal. So in that type of setting, you have to be very thoughtful. In addition, there is this concern for effect on triglycerides. Triglycerides can shoot up and may have to be managed with triglyceride-lowering agents. One other thing I would just say with asparaginase is that there is an increased risk of clot. That, too, is a potentially life-threatening challenge.
Any comments about inotuzumab or ozogamicin in ALL?
Well, there was a very, as I'm sure you know, there was a very important and timely New England Journal article that was recently published by Dr. Kantarjan and colleagues that showed that in the relapse refractory setting, inotuzumab ozogamicin appears to be superior in terms of a variety of outcomes, including overall survival, compared to standard conventional approaches for these patients. There is a signal, a real signal for veno-occlusive disease that needs to be considered, and that signal appears to be heightened in patients who have been previously transplanted and who have received myeloablative conditioning regimens.
Finally, in terms of ALL, any comments in terms of checkpoint inhibitors and CAR T therapy?
Well, with checkpoint inhibitors, again, I think that's very early in development, but there's many people looking at it. We have some interest. As far as CAR T, obviously that's a different story. I think there is still a lot of promise. There are many companies that are looking at CD19 targeted CAR T cells. The challenge is ALL patients as opposed to CLL patients and myeloma patients that you had mentioned tend to be more acutely sick, and the concern and risk for cytokine release syndrome and neurotoxicity, and it appears the incidence of these things are much higher and can be more dangerous. So they have to be under consideration.
So where do you see the future of CAR T therapy for ALL? And when do you think theoretically, I mean, I've heard it's being reviewed by the FDA. How is it going to be used?
We'll have to see. First, we have to demonstrate that it can be safely administered. CAR T cells have a lot of challenges, logistical challenges, toxicity that you have to watch for, managing these patients in the hospital, picking the right patient populations. So I think that I do see a future for CAR T cell technology, but I think we're still figuring it out in ALL. And I think that in the years ahead, we're going to have better and better products available for our patients in terms of CAR T. I do have a lot of optimism.
So let's finish out with just a word about APL. Maybe you could just briefly comment on your 45-year-old man.
So APL accounts for about 10% of our patients. And when we see it, we get excited because, one, you have to be very thoughtful about the potential complications of acute promyelocytic leukemia, which are DIC, or disseminated intravascular coagulation. If you don't recognize it and you treat it with conventional chemotherapy, you can increase the bleeding and clotting of DIC. So it is important, if you're worried about acute promyelocytic leukemia, that you initiate ATRA, and obviously that you, from the beginning, send these patients to a tertiary leukemia center with leukemia expertise. The other reason why we're excited about APL is because it has a 15-17 translocation to PML-RAR alpha rearrangement that leads to the block and differentiation at the level of the promyelocyte, which can be reversed with differentiating agents such as ATRA and arsenic trioxide. Traditionally and historically, acute promyelocytic leukemia has been treated with a combination of ATRA and chemotherapy, leading to high rates of remission and subsequently high rates of survival. More recently, again, a high-profile presentation and subsequent publication showed that you can combine all-trans retinoic acid with arsenic in low-risk and intermediate-risk APL patients and get many of them, the large majority of them, into remission with very improved survival. So I think currently our approach for patients, at least with low-risk, intermediate-risk APL, is combining treatment with ATRA, or all-trans retinoic acid, and arsenic trioxide.
Can you talk a little bit about what happened with this patient?
Sure. So this particular patient, a 45-year-old gentleman who came in with bleeding and pain following a dental procedure, he was found to have low blood counts, which is a common feature of acute promyelocytic leukemia. And in addition to that, he was having a lot of coagulopathy as manifested by his PT and PTT, as well as his very suppressed fibrinogen. Based on that picture alone and the presence of these very immature cells in the peripheral blood, he was initiated on all-trans retinoic acid before anything else to try and reverse the effects of the DIC. Thereafter, the molecular and chromosomal data revealed, and a few days later, that he did have the hallmarks of APL, namely the PML-RAR alpha rearrangement, the 15-17 translocation. Because his counts were low at presentation, he was deemed to be low-risk APL and was treated as per Dr. Lococo and colleagues with a combination of all-trans retinoic acid and arsenic trioxide in induction. That period of time of treatment when the blood counts differentiate can take about 4 to 6 weeks, towards oftentimes up to 6 weeks, where patients have to remain in the hospital and be monitored again for differentiation and differentiation syndromes and make sure that they do not have any untoward QT prolongation or liver enzyme elevation, which you can see with arsenic. And if their counts return and majority of them achieve remission, then they go on to receive consolidation treatment with ATRA and arsenic. And many of these folks do quite well.
What happened with him in terms of differentiation syndrome?
He actually developed shortness of breath, hypoxia, and had some pulmonary infiltrates. Some folks do not have pulmonary infiltrates. And I don't mention in the text here, but he also had some weight gain. So weight gain and pulmonary infiltrates and hypoxia, all of that, not necessarily all-inclusive. You know, you can have some of this. So if you have a patient with pulmonary manifestations, you should really consider treating the differentiation syndrome with steroids.
And what happened with him?
Well, we initiated him on dexamethasone, 10 milligrams twice a day intravenously, and within a period of about 3-4 days, his symptoms resolved. And then thereafter, we continued it for a week or two, if I remember correctly, and tapered him off.
We should note that subsequent to this recording, several agents have been approved for the treatment of ALL and AML. The indication for blinatumomab was expanded to include all patients with relapsed or refractory ALL, and inotuzumab ozogamicin was approved for the same indication. Tisanjec-leclusal CAR-T therapy was approved for the treatment of patients up to 25 years old with ALL that is refractory or in second or later relapse. Enasidenib was approved for the treatment of patients with relapsed or refractory AML with an IDH2 mutation. The liposomal encapsulation of daunorubicin and cytarabine, CPX351, was approved for the treatment of therapy-related AML or AML with myelodysplastic-related changes. Finally, gemtuzumab ozogamicin was approved for the treatment of patients with CD33-positive AML. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Acute Leukemias Update.